Welcome to Diet Culture Dropout. Are you ready to drop out of the $72 billion narrative that you've been sold? Diet culture sells us lies, unattainable beauty standards, the narrative that your body's inadequate, and dictates how you should define your health. It is pervasive, oppressive, and damaging to all areas of our health. By dropping out of diet culture, we can together celebrate all bodies, work towards dismantling weight stigma, and stop the transgenerational trauma of body shame and dieting. I'm your host, Athena Brown, a non-diet and body-inclusive registered dietitian, a certified intuitive eating counselor, yoga teacher, and a mom of two strong-willed daughters. My passion is helping people heal their relationship with their body and food so they can live a full life without restrictions, size limits, or food rules. I also desperately want to change the narrative for our kids so they can be the first generation that never diets, has resilience in our body-obsessed world, and a positive relationship with food. This podcast is a safe space for exploration, mindful moments, and take-home practices for anyone looking to find food peace and body liberation. Please remember that this is for educational purposes only and does not replace medical advice from your primary care provider, therapist, or registered dietitian. I am so happy you're here. I want you to know that wherever you are in your food and body peace journey, that there is room at this table for you. You are so worthy, just as you are right now. Do you want to join my non-diet community? If so, head on over to my website and join my Nourish newsletter at peacefullynourished.ca. It is a monthly dose of intuitive eating, body liberation, and satisfying food inspiration. Get exclusive offerings and discount codes right to your inbox. Plus, who does not love freebies? Also on my website is my free guide, 4 Steps to Food and Body Freedom, which is a 9-page PDF to help you get started on this journey. Then, if you're into snacking, which who isn't, check out my Peds Family Counseling page and grab my ultimate snacking guide. Enjoy. Welcome back. I'm so happy you're here. Today, we have the honor to have Sarah Kendall on the show. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Athena. I'm happy to be here.
So glad we got to connect. So today's topic, we're going to be talking all things binge eating disorder related. And this is an area that Sarah specializes in. But before we get to that, Sarah, would you be able to share with listeners a little bit more about who you are, where you're located, and how you found the work that you do?
Yeah, sure. So I've been a registered dietitian since 2008. I'm currently working in a private practice for myself in the Windsor, Essex area, but I operate virtually across Ontario. And I work with folks who identify as struggling with binge eating or feel like they are dealing with, you know, yo-yo dieting or chronic dieting, or generally just having some distress around food. They feel like they don't know what to eat. And so I use a non-diet weight inclusive approach, and I work with them around, you know, strategies to help them regulate their eating and to get back to a way of eating that feels good for them, you know, tap into their own internal wisdom so they can really just get back to living a life like outside of food and body worries. In terms of my background as a dietitian, I've really held a variety of roles since 2008, which at first it was, you know, I always was frustrated by it, but it actually served me really well. And I was introduced into the eating disorder field in 2014. Life kind of took me down to Florida, and one of the only jobs I could end up getting a work visa for was at an eating disorder program. And so I never thought that I would end up in that field. But when I started working there, I was working on an inpatient unit, day treatments and then intensive outpatient programs. And I started working with adults and adolescents. And when I returned back to Canada a year later, one of the only jobs in the contracts I could end up getting was always in the eating disorder specialty. And again, like I moved around so much when I returned back in 2015, but I was really lucky to work for a variety of programs in the province. So I'm working with teens, adults. And when the pandemic hit, I was kind of like feeling this pull towards wanting to move back to be with my family. And I still wanted to support folks in this field, but in the area, there wasn't a lot of opportunities. So it was like, this is my chance to kind of operate something virtually. And my heart really lies in working with folks with binge eating, because I feel like, you know, while it's the most, you know, it's the most common eating disorder, I feel like, you know, we're not doing enough to support these folks, because they are often waiting on wait lists for a long time, or they can't get access to a diagnosis. So I just feel like my private practice helps to fill that gap. So That's me in a nutshell and a little bit about the work that I do.
Yeah, very important work. And the next question I love asking people, just because we can't physically see ourselves through podcasting. So can you also share any identities or privileges that you feel are relevant for listeners to know?
So I would identify as like a cis white female. I exist in a thin, able body. I use she, her pronouns. I would also say that I am university educated. And I guess financially, I would identify as somebody who has like a single income household.
Mm-hmm. Perfect. Thank you. And because of the theme of the podcast is just generating more awareness of diet culture, can you give an example of how it's came up for you recently as a dietitian trying to help other people drop out of diet culture, how you witness it as well too?
I think because we're immersed in this work in the field of eating disorders and disordered eating, it's hard to not have that lens. And so I find it, honestly, it's never just one thing. It shows up often because it's in the books that I'm reading or the movies that I'm watching. You know, more recently I was reading a book, I think it's one of the books by Stanley Tucci, like one of his most recent ones. And there was a lot of like good food, bad food mentality written in it. And I noticed for me, it makes me feel just kind of frustrated that it's like, there's very few things that you can do where it doesn't show up. And I think while I feel like my relationship with food and my body is in a good place, I often think of, you know, the clients that I work with or the people that are out there that are struggling with that. And I get angry and upset by that because I worry about them. And I think it just speaks to this uphill battle we have in regards to dismantling diet culture. So,
absolutely. So yeah. Mm-hmm. It's just triggering literally everywhere, just trying to do some self-care and read a book and it's hitting you again.
Yeah. Yeah. And actually I think I noticed I have that gratitude journal that's pretty popular. I can't think of the name right now, but even in the way that it talks about how, like the evidence around like how gratitude practice can work, they even there's diet culture in there. Like they speak to like this hierarchy of bodies and things like that. And I'm just like, there's no escaping it. Or it feels like there's no escaping.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you for sharing. Great example. Yeah. So today's main interview topic, we're going to be just kind of scratching the surface of exploring binge eating disorder. So can you start us off by kind of describing what binge eating disorder is, or maybe other terms or words that may resonate for listeners to kind of identify what we're meaning here?
Yeah. So I think it's important to note that, you know, people in any body size can experience what we call binge eating. And it can be experienced for people across like all races, genders, and identities, and including like, you know, people who have a variety of privileges. And binging would be, you know, where somebody's eating a large amount of food, kind of like in a single eating moment. And sometimes people feel like they feel like this compulsion towards eating, like this pull towards eating, even mm-hmm. when they're not feeling hungry. Sometimes people will say, like, I feel like I'm always emotionally eating. Some people will describe that as like anytime they feel kind of like an intense emotion or experience a situation, you know, that could be really kind of cueing them that they need to turn towards food. Yeah. And I think for a lot of folks, they can feel this perceived sense of being addicted to food. So some people will often mm-hmm. say, like, I feel like I'm addicted to food.
Yes.
So there's a wide variety of things or labels that are put on it, like compulsive eating, emotional eating, food addiction, binging, but mm-hmm. it's not the same thing as like the clinical diet. The clinical eating disorder, which is binge eating disorder.
Mm-hmm. And how do we define that, I guess, or meet those criteria to be diagnosed as binge eating disorder?
Yeah, sure. So in the DSM-5 in 2013, they finally introduced binge eating disorder as they acknowledge that it is an eating disorder. So essentially it's characterized by, you know, again, eating a large amount of food in a single sitting. One of the defining features though, is this sense of a lack of control over eating. When I'm working with folks, people have said, you know, I'm blacking out. I feel like I can't stop. Mm-hmm. It feels almost like they're wildly disconnected from their bodies.
Yeah.
Right.
Disassociated.
You got it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it causes a lot of distress, right? You know, they're often eating past the point of feeling full. And so mm-hmm. they can, and sometimes for some folks, that's kind of like the cue, like, oh, I need to stop eating when they're feeling really sick. And so other things that are associated with the diagnosis is, you know, people can sometimes feel such a sense of shame around their eating behavior that they're eating in secret, you know, waiting. I've worked with folks where they're like waiting for family members or roommates to leave the room so they can go and binge. Some people even plan their binges. Mm-hmm. Folks will often too feel like this range of emotions afterwards, like feeling really disgusted or like a lot of guilt. Shame is a really big one for them. And so again, just really highlighting this, a lot of distress around the binging. And I would say that access to getting a diagnosis can be really hard for folks. So I want to just say that if you haven't received a diagnosis, it doesn't mean that, you know, this isn't real, like you deserve help and support. But mm-hmm. one of the other things around the binging is that usually it's happening for at least, you know, one episode a week for a period of like at least 3 months. And the symptoms of like how often it's happening could range from, you know, mild to extreme. So like one binging episode to like up to 14 or more.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And just very distressing, and the shame spirals. Yeah, that usually that emotional pull too, like after, is just really deep and strong. Yeah. So, how common is this form of eating disorder?
Yeah. So, I think we need a bit more research updates on the actual numbers, but on average, I believe it ranges from 3 to 5 million people. It's the most common eating disorder. So it's three times more likely to have binge eating than anorexia or bulimia. It's often, and the reason I was speaking to we need more research is because eating disorders often go undiagnosed. And we've also seen a surge in people coming forward with disordered eating or eating disorder behaviors mm-hmm. during the pandemic. And I think too, the other piece of that is that because there's a lot of stigma around eating disorders and shame that folks have around their eating behaviors, it may prevent them from seeking out support. And mm-hmm. so I really believe that those numbers are probably quite high.
Yeah. Yeah. And especially too, like I didn't even, again, air quoting, become a DSM approved eating disorder mm-hmm. until 2013. So just yeah. getting like the doctors on board and the researchers, like so many years of, you know, stats have not been collected as well. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so we think too, thinking about, you know, it's more common than things like other diagnoses, like HIV, schizophrenia, and even breast cancer. And I think just highlighting that, because I know, so we're in Ontario, Canada, and I think it's interesting that it's one of the most common eating disorders. It's more prevalent than some of these other health issues. And yet in our province, there's not a whole lot of eating disorder programs that even offer treatment for it.
Yeah.
So there is a gap there. Mm-hmm.
And just the screening as well too. Like if we take mm-hmm. breast cancer, for instance, everybody is, you know, aware of it. You're getting letters in the mail from the government. Make sure you mm-hmm. do your screens, et cetera. It's very well organized and it seems like they're really, you know, putting their best effort to tackle it versus,
you got it,
you know, a very serious mental health disorder that a lot of practitioners don't even feel confident like screening or knowing like what questions or things to ask.
So you got it's it.
Really distressing the support and then also the competence of the providers kind of recognizing it as well too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think another mm-hmm. thing that's important to know is that on average, people are usually in their mid-20s when they get diagnosed. I don't know, but my experience too working with teens is I feel like I'm starting to see more and more teens with the experience of binging. That's just mm-hmm. in my own practice, mm-hmm. but it's just something that I've noticed. However, on, you know, the research shows that on average, the age is around 25 years old. There's a really strong genetic component to who may develop, you know, binge eating or could be at risk of developing. There's, I think it's more than 50% or around 50%. You know, around 40% of those with binge eating are usually males. And the other thing that's correlated to is, you know, trauma. People who experience trauma in their life are also potentially at risk of getting a binge eating disorder or having the experience of binge eating. Mm-hmm.
And I just want to kind of jump in there too, like however, yeah. how big or how small the trauma could be as well. You know, mm-hmm. in one of my professional development courses, they were talking about how dieting is a form of trauma. And
you got it.
That's something I never considered a trauma before. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think if we just spend some time maybe just talking about that, like I think when we think about existing as a human being in this world, right, like we've evolved in our primary purpose is to like stay alive. And, oh. you know, when food is being restricted or you don't have access to food, you know, that's a threat to your survival. Mm-hmm. And I don't think actually, you know, even in our teaching as dietitians, like I don't actually ever think that was, you know, I don't remember learning about that, but it's a threat to our survival. And so it impacts your nervous system and it increases that drive towards food, right? So it makes sense why people would turn towards food, or that might be all you'll think about it. And I know we'll probably chat about this later, but it's threatening your survival. So it makes sense, right? Mm-hmm, that is absolutely. A form of trauma.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good. And then the other pieces to add is
yeah,
these ones I think, completely, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, no, that's okay. I think one of the things it's important too, that anybody seeking like, you know, weight loss treatments or seeking like weight loss counseling, you know, there's research that shows that almost 30 to 40% of those folks may actually be dealing with binge eating. So I think, again, when you were talking about screening, right, it would be important for maybe people working in those areas, you know, even like in the case of like weight loss surgeries or bariatrics, to be screening for that. I think one of the other numbers is that almost 70% of people seeking weight loss surgeries, bariatric surgery, meet the diagnostic criteria for binge eating disorder. That's a large percentage of people.
Mm-hmm. And again, if we're not addressing that very complicated mental health problem, you know, the surgery, you're still going to come out with the same, you know, mental health state post-surgery. Mm-hmm. So that's a big, big challenge and a big loss, I guess, towards people's health too, by mm-hmm. not being able to get one the right of the, help.
Yeah, exactly. And I just want to add that I did work for an outpatient eating disorder program, and we had a group that supported folks with binge eating. And oftentimes people who were seeking out bariatric surgery from one of the other programs in the hospital, if they were screened as being at risk for binge eating disorder, they would actually get sent to our program first, and they would do the group program. And it was actually really interesting because, I mean, I was only on this program for about a year, so I don't know all of the statistics on it, but it was interesting to see how after they went through the binge eating disorder treatment, by the end of it, many of them actually decided that they no longer wanted to have the bariatric surgery. Wow. So there really is value in screening folks and getting them the help that they need. Yeah. Right.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Great. So we've kind of touched on some of the risk factors, but what would be any other risk factors for developing binge eating disorder, Sarah?
Yeah, so for sure, dieting could be a driving force behind developing binge eating. So, you know, and I think having people develop more awareness around even the word dieting, because dieting can look like many different things now, you know, so not eating enough food, restricting certain foods, you know, lifestyle changes, counting macros, all of these things could be a form of dieting or food restriction. Thinking about, you know, so outside of genetics, you know, even your family environment or the home environment or the environment that you live in, you know, and what I'm speaking to is if you're not living with your family or if you're living with like roommates or other people, if there's a lot of talk about dieting or there's, you know, shaming of bodies and things like that, or maybe even messages around like clean plate mentality, you know, or even the impact of food access in those environments, those may also be a cue towards binging. We've talked about genetics, life stressors, you know, when people also have like internalized negative attitudes towards the way that they eat or how they feel about their body, you know, it can lead to a lot of like poor self-esteem, which, you know, that's self-esteem is about how you see yourself, like your worth and your value. And that can create that shame spiral, which again could potentially, you know, trigger binge eating or coping with food. Weight stigma, you know, we talk about internalized weight stigma, but there's also weight stigma just out and about in the media, message, you know, comments from friends and family about your body, your doctor even commenting on your body. Other things, you know, there's other types of diagnoses that somebody might have. So like mood disorders, depression, anxiety. There's a link with ADHD and substance abuse that could also drive binge eating. And yeah, and so food access is a big one too. So folks, you know, dealing with food insecurity, again, that would make sense, right? Because that food deprivation.
Yeah. So lots of variety of factors there. And one of your points, I just kind of want to expand on a little bit more, Sarah, is where you're talking about the binging being like a comfort or some kind of coping mechanism. And I think I always love exploring this, you know, alternative view of the binge, because so many of them, you know, focus on that being the problem. and them not being able to control it, but just kind of looking at it as like an extraordinary adaptive behavior and how, you know, they were surviving, thriving through, you know, very challenging times. So how, in your view, do you perceive the binge maybe in more of a positive manner as a coping mechanism and as an adaptive behavior?
So if folks are experiencing something that feels, you know, so outside of maybe, let's say, food restriction driving the binging, if folks, you know, are experiencing some kind of intense emotion, or they've gone through some trauma, you know, they may not have the skills or understand what to do with that. So they could feel, you know, as humans, you know, we don't like to feel uncomfortable or discomfort, right? We're not hardwired to just sit there and enjoy that because it doesn't feel good, right? Yep. And so we're often looking for comfort, like something to be soothing. Like, I don't, you know, if you're feeling overwhelmed, it's like, oh, how can I get relief from this? Mm-hmm. And so for some people, turning towards food makes sense, because when we eat, it does release that feel good hormone, right? It gives us a little bit of like a dopamine hit. And so, you know, in the short term, it's kind of giving you, you're seeking that comfort. It, food is offering that bit of a distraction, you get that relief, right?
Some kind of safety for that moment.
You got it. You got it. And so it makes sense how it can become this cycle of every time you experience maybe something that triggers you, or you're experiencing that emotion again, it's kind of like, oh, you know, I'm going to turn towards food again, right? And it can create that cycle if somebody doesn't have other ways of coping or knowing how to deal with it. So yeah, it's really kind of like your body, for where you're at in that moment, it's kind of like your body has that wisdom to get you to find ways to comfort yourself. The only, the piece of that though, is that because it's kind of like the short-term release, it makes you feel good in the moment. The problem is that it actually doesn't help you resolve the issue that lies underneath, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's where we invite people to maybe get curious and, you know, seek support to explore that, maybe like with a therapist if you have access to that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Very good. Thank you. And I know we kind of already touched on this already, but how does dieting, weight loss, again, sometimes people don't resonate with the word dieting, like you had mentioned, but any kind of like disordered eating, modification, food restriction, fuel, more binging.
Yeah. Yeah. So we kind of refer to it as like this restrict binge cycle. So, and I'll talk about it like from like the food perspective first, and then also how emotions can still drive that cycle as well. So, you know, if somebody is feeling, you know, let's just say maybe uncomfortable with their body size or feeling like they need to change their way of eating, you know, they're trying to take control of like the situation essentially. So if they set on this path of dieting, however that looks, you know, counting your macros, Whole30, whatever it is, it leads to that threat of deprivation, which can lead to intense hunger cravings, you know, well, you would get intense hunger, but also cravings for food too, right? And more often than not, people find that they're craving those foods that have become off limits. So those foods that have been deemed bad or often like unhealthy. And so really what happens is biology kind of sets in and it gets you to seek out that food. And what often happens is people then start to binge on those foods that have been off limits. And this can often result in people feeling, again, a lot of distress and shame around how they're eating because they've eaten the foods that have been deemed bad or not good. And then what sets in is, you know, this, I will try again tomorrow, right? And so it sets them out on another path of restriction. And that's how this cycle can persist. And people can, you know, that cycle, even in the absence of like, let's just say someone was eating like what they felt was enough, but they find that they're still turning towards food or binging on food. Sometimes it's often because of some unmet, like, emotional need. So that can still drive that cycle. So that feeling of being deprived, maybe of something, like, emotionally.
Yeah. Thank you.
You're welcome.
And then we've already kind of touched on this point as well too, but how has our traditional healthcare system really missed the mark on this significant and serious eating disorder?
Yeah. So there's a quote by Dr. Jennifer Gaudiani, and she says the number one medical complication of binge eating disorder is substandard general medical and surgical care arising from weight stigma. And, you know, I have to say, like, even as dietitians, I mean, you know, I was educated back in the early 2000s. And so it was very much a weight centric approach where everything about health was focused on what you eat, how you move your body, and, like, what do you weigh? And so there's still folks in the medical community that have that lens. So when people are going to the doctor, you know, if it's, I don't know, let's say sometimes, like, I've had people who have had hernias or, you know, other kind of, like, health issues, they're going in for that, but they're often blamed or shamed for their weight or told to lose weight and that will solve your problems. Or even folks who go in and say to a doctor, you know, I'm struggling, like, I feel out of control around food, I feel like I'm binging. I've had folks be given the message that, well, your weight's where it needs to be. And I think that sends a really harmful message to people. And so things can get misdiagnosed, not diagnosed at all. It can lead to people feeling like they don't want to go back to the doctor's office, right? So weight stigma, you know, this discrimination around, you know, people's body size, it's a real problem and it's a real health issue.
Yeah. So moving towards more of a positive outlook now, how does recovery look like, or what would this look like for your clients in your practice, Sarah?
So there is hope, and people can heal their relationship with food and body. And I believe that for all folks, right? And again, I know it's about having access to these supports, but usually people, if they can get connected with a team, so like a dietitian, you know, a medical, you know, like your GP, maybe if you even have a psychiatrist involved and working with a dietitian, those people can help wrap around you to come up with, you know, depending on what you feel like you're ready for, what you need, help you kind of carve out a treatment plan. And from a nutrition point of view, I'm often working with people to stabilize their eating. So we're building in really that structure, consistency, getting enough, right? To kind of draw, or that would lay down, like, the foundation for folks trying to, you know, heal a relationship with food in their body, making sure that they're getting enough. And then also starting to get curious about what sorts of things are making somebody vulnerable for binging, right? So we start to get curious, start to notice and build awareness around that, you know, and then also working towards more food variety. So part of that looks like, you know, first of all, working with people to kind of help them give themselves permission to eat all food. I think there's a misconception that this message from dietitians is like, oh yeah, you can eat cookies and cakes all day. And like, no, that's not what we're saying. It's like removing this moral code around food, or like you know, Aaron Flores in one of his teachings talks about, like, you know, the emotional value that's being placed on food. Right? Yes. We're trying to dismantle this hierarchy around food, because that can drive binging. And one of the ways it does that is it creates this psychological deprivation around food. Like, so if I'm saying can't ever have a cookie, but you've enjoyed cookies in the past, well, you're always going to be thinking about that cookie versus somebody who moved towards, you know, I give myself, like, cookies are nutritious, cookies taste good. I give myself permission to eat this. You'll notice that you become habituated to it and it becomes a little bit less desirable, right?
Exactly.
So And I think that, you know, that's a really important part of the work that we want to do is like, yes, you got to eat enough. Work on giving yourself permission to eat all foods. And that's really hard. I don't want to make it sound like it's easy because it when we're starting to eat more or somebody's starting to eat more, you know, that control over food, right? If we're starting to add more and you feel like it's not being controlled in a way that you thought was good for you, it can kind of create this backdraft of emotions, right? We're starting to, so this is why we want to have like a treatment team in place. You know, the therapist can help you with that. So yeah, there's lots of things. But really we're trying to, you know, also reduce the shame. You know, the cycle of binge eating is not, it's not about willpower, right? So we kind of like help, you know, I work to help people understand like why that's happening, why that experience is happening for them. And, you know, just also working on identifying, you know, how that internalized weight stigma too is showing up for them. And so working as well with your therapist around, you know, some of the body image pieces. Yeah. So there's a lot there, working on, you know, working through like unhelpful thoughts and beliefs about food, really unpacking your food rules. Yeah. I also just want to point out too that for many of the people I work with, more often than not, I would say most people I work with get connected with some kind of like group support as well, because there's healing and connection with other people, right? That kind of have similar experience, or you know, you get at the space where you can kind of like share your story, or like your even your body story too, right?
Yeah,
it can be really therapeutic for people.
Being amongst other people in community is so healing.
Yes. Yes, like our nervous systems need that, right? Because I think, you know, eating disorders across the spectrum, they can, there's so much stigma around them, and they can feel so isolating, and it's like so connection with others, whether it's in the group format or maybe just, you know, like being around friends and family, you know, even coworkers that you feel safe with, right? Sometimes it's not even just about like sharing your story about what you're going through, but sometimes it's about surrounding yourself with people who aren't always talking about diets, their bodies and things like that, right? That could be really helpful in recovery.
Of course. I love that one. Great. So anything more you want to add?
Yeah, I think just some other tips that I have would be, you know, if you're feeling distress around your eating, I really want to invite you to get support because you deserve that. You deserve to not feel that way around food in your body. You know, if you have access to it, even if you're unsure of where to start, the NEDIC website would be a great touch point to help you. You know, you can contact their customer service to get connected maybe with, you know, supports in your area. I just really think it's important for people to get help because you deserve to feel better.
And there is hope, so much hope. It doesn't have to be this way, and you're not alone.
Yeah, there is another side, right, where it's like where, you know, outside of these issues around eating, like you can create more space to really live a life that's in alignment with the values that you have, or like the goals that you want to, you know, and sometimes I hate using the word goals, but I mean like, you know, the life events that you want to experience, right? Because, but that's really hard to do when there's all these thoughts and worries about food and body. I hope that people too, in the process, I think another thing that can be helpful is really, I think I mentioned this, but carving out time for more joy and pleasure, like that's part of self-care. And I don't just mean things like, you know, the bubble baths and stuff like that, but connection with others or hobbies and interests that you enjoy. Yeah.
Yeah.
Another way to get that dopamine hit outside of food, right?
Mm-hmm. Great. Yeah. So just to wrap everything up then, Sarah, what is the single most protective action someone can take to protect themselves from diet culture?
Single most. I don't know about single most thing.
Give me your hot one tip. I know it's a big ask.
Yeah. I think for folks to just notice, like, do you have this, is there like this hierarchical system that you have around foods or moral code around foods? And can you work on giving yourself permission to eat all foods? You know, just start to know, become more aware of like how that might show up for you, right? That good food, bad food mentality. And I think working to remove those labels and just notice, like, how does it make you feel? How do you feel when you're naming foods good or bad, or versus when you practice, you know, just letting a chocolate bar be a chocolate bar, right? Kind of, yes, doing an experiment around that, right? Yep. And again, that takes a lot of work, but it really, it's important to remove those labels. I think, you know, when I'm working with people, I primarily work with adults, and I often hear from them about their childhood experiences around, you know, certain foods being off limits, or there would be like the special cupboard with certain foods that were bad, you know? So I think just inviting parents to maybe just start to notice, like, do you kind of have that system in your house, and can you work towards just allowing those foods, like for, you know, your children or your teens to have those foods if they feel like they're craving it or they want to eat it. You know, our body has a lot of wisdom, and we can become habituated around these foods and we won't be craving them, but foods will have more power when they're off, quote unquote, like off limits or bad. Mm-hmm. So
of course. Yeah. So is that your point for the next one? How do people protect diet culture from kids or little people in their lives taking that approach?
Yeah, I think it's part of it. I also just, again, this is, you know, beyond your ask of just one thing, but I think for families I think when we think about weight stigma, I think because that's a huge health issue, yes, I think for families or parents to move away from talking about bodies and, you know, commenting on bodies, and even your own body, commenting on your own body, or unpacking any kind of maybe some unhelpful thoughts or beliefs you might have about food, body image, things like that. You working through that too can also be really helpful for those young impressionable minds that are in your home, right?
Yeah.
And I also just want to say that, you know, for kids, it's normal for their body, kids and teens, right? They're going through growth and development. It's normal for their bodies to change. And so just, yeah.
Speaking like about letting it and loving them for just who they are and what they, you know, are meant to be, you know, the body they're supposed to grow into, type thing. Yeah.
Just, you got it.
That. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's,
yeah,
such a good one. Great. So where can listeners find you, Sarah, and learn more about your work?
Yeah. So people can reach out to me through my website, which is sarahkendallrd.com. I'm not really active on Instagram, but I do have an Instagram. It's at sarahkendallrd. But yeah, you can just shoot me an email, or I offer discovery calls, and we can chat a bit more about how we might be able to work together.
Great. I will link all of that in the notes. So thank you so much, Sarah, for your time and expertise on this topic.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here and to share more information on this really, like, often overlooked or underdiagnosed eating disorder.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I hope you enjoyed listening to Diet Culture Dropout. If you like today's podcast, I would love for you to leave a review, share the episode with a friend, or subscribe. The more we can collectively break down diet culture,
the closer we get to food peace and celebrating all bodies. Thanks for being here.